welcome you to the first Philosophy Society special Sunday school. Okay, apart from that, the only thing I've got to do is introduce someone who's so well known to you, I don't need to introduce him. And indeed, someone whose views are on whose views this whole day is pinned. Because every time I give a talk here, somewhere from the audience comes a question from Charles. And as we know, it's always about the same sort of thing. And some of you, quite a lot of you in fact, asked me if Charles could have a special day because they wanted to hear more about Charles' views. Because it's always the case, of course, when there's a weekend that I or somebody has to cut him off in full flow because we've got other things to talk about. But now he's got the whole day not quite to himself because we've got to have somebody speaking in opposition to him. But let's hear your views, Charles. We're looking forward to them.
Thank you very much. First of all, Tim, there were some late arrivals. Could you hand up the... We have a little plastic folder with some gem in it. It's mostly copies of the transparencies that I'll be projecting on here. There is one bit, the staple sheets stapled together are not what I'm saying today, but they're the gist of it. Very concise. They were done for our own review magazine back in 97, so they're 5 years old. I'm hoping it's a little bit better after 5 years. I've learned from experience that when one talks about morality, fairly quickly, if you're not careful, you're into life, the universe and everything, and one gets off the point. So if I could please say no questions please until the end. There will, I hope, be time at the end. For those who are regular attendants here, the gist of what I'm saying they all know anyway, but I'm hoping there's some new stuff as well. It's all fairly highly condensed, and it requires some of the argument is fairly dense, so it requires a lot of concentration, and certainly from yourselves, please, if you can sustain it for the best part of the first hour. And for that reason, mainly to discipline myself in terms of time, because if I begin to improvise, of course I'll use up time. I'm going to stick pretty rigidly to my notes, you know. So if I appear to be attending too much to my notes, there's a good reason. There's a good reason for it. Besides which, I'm not sure I can remember it all anyway, off the top of my head. Naturalistic ethics. I prefer the word natural, by the way, but naturalistic, okay, because people conventionally understand it. And I take ethics and morality to mean the same thing, so I won't differentiate between them. And I also take them to be, in the broadest sense, the study of how ought we to live, an attempt to answer the question, how ought we to live, both in terms of private, personal morality, how ought I to live, and public morality, for example, politics. I'm not implying that all politicians are automatically therefore moral, but that's the sense in which I'm looking at morality. I'll be covering a lot of concepts, and there simply isn't time for me to try to justify them, even if I could justify all of them. And I'll be saying what is the case often. And I know from experience that when I say something is the case, people sometimes complain that I'm being dogmatic. I'm not trying to be dogmatic. I may be trying to sort of emphasize something. It's all hypothetical. There is no dogmatism involved at all. There is no certainty involved at all. It's all hypothetical. It's all probable. What I'm saying is that if what I'm putting forward is the case, then certain things logically follow from it. I'm hoping that somewhere today or later on, somebody will come back to me and say, but it isn't the case because of this, or it doesn't follow because of that. That would be great if I can get some sort of feedback. If you don't get feedback, then you begin to think that you're right, which is dangerous. What I'm seeking is a foundation, an underpinning theory. I'm not getting into practical morality or any particular moral code. I'm talking about just theory, at least. Also, I'm looking for what good means. I'm not going to be talking about what things are good, mother, love, apple pie, or whatever. I'm looking for what good means, fairly abstract, theoretical, what it is for a thing to be good, not what things are good. So that's, and those are fairly narrow terms of reference, and I've got to try to stick within those. I'm addressing also only what's natural, not supernatural, metaphysical, mystical, or religious. Purely the natural. And by natural, in the widest sense, I mean those things that come under what we loosely call the laws of nature, such as incomplete as they are, such as we know them. So that's what I'm going to be trying to be talking about. About 20-odd years ago, I began to have a bit more spare time from my work to pick up more systematically what I had always done anyway, with fairly wide but somewhat undisciplined reading on what it all about, you know, how does the world work. I started doing that by going to impose some system on myself by going to local university evening classes scheduled for some years, and eventually I found Woolley House, and I've been coming down here ever since, engaged on this whole exercise, using philosophy as the vehicle to try to discipline what I was doing. And my general reading had led me to consider morality to be about behavior, and behavior to be about basically survival. In other words, that morality was essentially a biological concept, and it seemed to me blindingly obvious, and I never seriously considered it, nor could I believe that anyone else could seriously consider it. I became particularly interested in the acceleration of naturalism that happened during the Enlightenment, and I found fairly easily philosophers whose views corresponded, as it were, with what I was tentatively thinking. Obviously Spinoza, when he equated God with nature, for example, the Scottish philosopher Hutchinson, he said the moral sense is simply a natural tendency to approve certain affections which tend to the public good. And Charles Darwin himself, in 1871, in The Descent of Man, he said, any animal whatever endowed with well-marked social instincts would inevitably acquire a moral sense or conscience as soon as its intellectual powers had become as well-developed or nearly as well-developed as in man. So those were obviously in line with my own intuitions. But of course there are two or three flies that appeared in the ointment. The first one, which I'd never come across until I started studying systematically, of course, was Hume at the beginning of the 18th century, when he said, well, you know, we're going along discussing morality, and we're talking about what is the case, and then all of a sudden, imperceptibly, we're talking about what ought to be the case. And this leap from is to ought, he said, is imperceptible, but it's fundamental, he said, of the last consequence, what he said, and of course he was right. So what he was, but Hume wasn't saying that we can't justify that. He was just saying that habitually we don't. So I thought, well, I can't ignore him, so I've got to take him on board and try to do something about it. Then the next generator of flies was about 100 years ago. Well, he must have been writing it right now 100 years ago. Principia Ethica, G.E. Moore, was published in 1903, so it's almost exactly 100 years. And he went a little bit further. He talked about the is-ought gap, but strangely enough, without mentioning Hume. And he said, not only that there are steps, like Hume said, that we don't take, but there are steps that cannot be taken. Which I found took me back. You know, I believe if you work hard enough at it, you can take almost any step that cannot be taken. And he said, for Moore, he said that for him, ethics is the general inquiry into what is good. And then the question, so the basic question is, what is this thing? What is this good? And he says, that's the most fundamental question in all ethics. Unless this first question be fully understood and its true answer clearly recognized, the rest of ethics is as good as useless from the point of view of systematic knowledge. I've written here, amen to that. And when I read it, I thought, wow, at last somebody's getting down to the nitty-gritty. But then he said, and I'm quoting here, good is good, and that's the end of the matter. It cannot be defined, and that is all I have to say about it. Propositions about good are all synthetic, never analytic. Good is an absolutely simple notion, like yellow. It is not complex, it is not composed of any parts, and so it is not analyzable. And though he didn't say it in as many words, what he was also getting at is in terms of there's no tautology, there's no single word or single symbol tautology for it. It's an absolutely simple thing. It cannot be expressed in terms of something else. Moreover, he said, good is non-natural. He didn't explain what non-natural meant, but that's obviously highly relevant to this day's business. He didn't argue these points much. He asserted them, and basically intuitively. He wasn't very happy with being told he was an intuitionist, but that's how it comes across, certainly to me. But for Moore, not only is good non-natural, but any attempt to define it in natural terms, like I'm trying to do today, will fail, will commit what he called the naturalistic fallacy. For example, if someone tried to define good as meaning some kind of natural X, whatever it might be, one could then ask, okay, but is X itself good? And that question would somehow seem to make sense, would somehow be meaningful, whereas if good meant X, asking is good X doesn't really make much sense. But when we do ourselves ask, is X good, it does seem to make some sense. The word he used was significant. He said it seems to be significant. In other words, intuitively again, saying good means X could never be a tautology. Whether X itself was good would always be what he called, and what most people have thought it since then, still an open question. So that together with Hume's is all. It gives you big problems for any naturalistic ethics. There's a long literature on all of this, especially about the naturalistic fallacy, and Moore himself admitted later on to many confusions. He was very honest about this, but even admitting the confusions, he still held out to say that his basic conclusions were right. The naturalistic, or at least he still held them, the naturalistic fallibility, the non-definability, and the non-naturalness of good. R.M. Hare, who we had here with us a few years ago at our weekend, and who died recently, very famous moral philosopher, he discussed the naturalistic fallacy at length in several of his books. He insisted it would always bite any attempt at a natural morality. If good was to be defined, it would inevitably appear also somewhere in the definition. In terms of a mathematical analogy, if you had an equation of the world, with good in it somewhere, you could not solve that equation to isolate good. You could not end up with good like X only on one side of the equation. It would inevitably creep in, even though you wouldn't know it. If the linguistic analysts got at it, they would find good in it. Good will always appear on both sides. But surely, it seemed to me, even considering all of this, for a start, what we are looking for in terms of Moore isn't a narrow definition of good. What we want to do is to understand, first of all, what morality is about. What are we doing when we do morality? We want to know what it's about. I want to know how morality fits into the world. Defining good, we can come back to as a second order question. But in the last 100 years or so since Principia Ethica, and certainly in the last 50 years or so, almost all we've had is logical analysis of the language in which morality is expressed, with lateral thought. I'm overstating a little bit here, but I'm allowed a bit of poetic justice and a poetic license, I think. With lateral thought inhibited by what Moore said cannot be done. Hare's last book, for example, which was only published 2 or 3 years ago, called Sorting Out Ethics, seems to me to be a paradigm example of that. At the end of 100 years, and the sort of things I'm interested in, what's ethics really about, we're no further forward, in my opinion. But are philosophers there only to clarify logically propositions advanced by other people? Are they to venture no propositions, no speculations of their own? Remember, Kant said, going back to the Enlightenment, that the message of the Enlightenment was aude sapere, dare to understand, dare to speculate. We've lost sight of that in many ways. Logical analysis, it seems to me, can seek nothing short of certainty. We had a weekend on skepticism. We're talking about certainty. And too much logical analysis, it says here, produces conceptual paralysis. We've surely learned by now that uncertainty appears to be inherent in the universe. Probability is all we can expect. Logical analysis is useful, even perhaps necessary. It is not sufficient. Nevertheless, by whatever philosophical route, the basic problem is still the same: how to get from ought to is. Now, the process somehow involved in that is on the first slide, which is Can everybody read that, by the way? Andrew? What happens in most ordinary conventional morality is that something is the case, and then somebody says, well, if that's the case, you ought to do X. It's a two-stage thing. What I'm saying is that, in fact, it's somehow a four-stage thing. Something is the case, in certain situations, you ought to do X. I'm saying, in fact, in between there are two things that are somehow there. Something we call, we intuit as a boundary. I'm using intuit a lot today because a lot of what we do is totally unconscious. It's intuition, not deliberate, open reasoning. To be good is somehow to be of something we call value, of worth. And secondly, when this value works on us, it produces somehow, this is a moral situation, there's some sort of pressure put on us. It's not quite an imperative, but it's some sort of force. People talk about moral force. And I'm saying that some kind of force, some kind of drive, in the normal sort of mathematical way of showing a force, you know, an arrow pointing one way or the other. So there's the problem. Where did this value and this force come from? Not surprisingly, non-natural analytic philosophy cannot tell us. It has nothing to say about those two things. It talks about that and that, nothing for those. That's how I see it. So back to the natural basics, back to basics. That's the problem. The second transparency is in fact taken from the stable together sheet we've got. And it's just one part of that. What is it to be a human being? It's basically what I'm asking. To be a participant in this thing we call life. To be part of the organic process. And what is it to be an organism? At its most basic, to be an organism on Earth anyway, is to be a member of a class of stable, complex, ordered molecular processes based on carbon chemistry and self-sustaining, far from thermal equilibrium, through their open, dissipative structure. Bacteria and algae are such processes, so are all other plants, animals, etc., including humans. Those are not my words, it's a definition which I've taken from a particular book. On your printout, there's another one below it, which is another definition from another book. I put two in so that you would have two examples, and that might make the whole thing a bit clearer. I won't bother with a second one from the point of view of pressure of time. The first organisms evolved through physical processes from the plentiful supply of already surprisingly complex carbon-based molecules on the surface of the Earth. As you probably know from your reading, we are bombarded from space by complex molecules of all kinds, a lot of them very complex carbon-based. Amino acids, for example, are dropping out of the skies on it. And the early Earth would be carpeted with stuff like this. Already complex carbon-based molecules. This organic evolution, including humans, has been continuous and has involved nothing other than the laws of physics. As far as we know, the Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago. The first fossils, I think, are at the fossils of life, organic fossils, are at the 3.8 billion years. Amazing how quickly the organic process got going. There were only single-celled creatures right up until 540 million years ago. And 540 million years ago, all of a sudden, they started combining to produce multicellular creatures like ourselves. And our bodies contain billions of cells. There were only single-celled creatures up until only 540 million years ago. That's incredible. And of course, during the last 9 million years, that human beings, in any detectable sense, have come on the scene. When we parted company with our cousins, gorillas and chimpanzees and so on, from whatever our common pre-hominid ancestor was. So that's the time scale. And I'm saying that that's been continuous and has evolved nothing from outside. Nothing supernatural, physical processes, and the naturally emergent properties thereof. Now, you notice on here, highlighted the most important points here, stable, complex, and self-sustaining. Those are the things. So if you don't remember any of this, yeah, those are the important points. And again, pressure of time, we'll condense this as much as we can. What's happening, if we call that order, we call that time and complexity. Is that right? Yes. And down here at the very bottom, we'll call that thermal equilibrium. When everything's at the same center, nothing's happening very much. Increasing that way and increasing that way. I'm treating time and complexity as being, they're obviously correlated. Time may be a linear, the complexity gets more and more as it goes on. It's probably steeply exponential, but for our purposes, I'll just treat them as both being linear, because I'm just trying to give you a notion of what I'm talking about. And on the early Earth, I'm talking first of all about complexity. In the last 30 years or so, complexity has become a science, and very much studied by mathematicians. We had a weekend here not so long ago on chaos theory, which is a sort of subset of complexity. And the situation is, I won't enter it any further, but when anything, any physical thing like gases or liquids, water for example, or gas, the atmosphere on Jupiter, the atmosphere on Earth, get into a sufficiently complex state, not only by what they're made up of, you know, water, H2O molecules, but also with a heat appliance and sufficient energy, there will occur spontaneously self-organization. Spontaneously. Anything at all, if you get it to a level of sufficient complexity, remember hypothetical? Anything at all, when you get it to sufficient complexity, and there's sufficient energy and the temperature and pressure that are right, etc., all other things be equal, boom, self-organization moves into being. We don't know how it happens. We're pretty sure that it happens, we're here. The truth is something like that happened. How it happened, we still don't know. That's why the science of complexity is still very much in its infancy. So you can imagine what happened is it takes some time for the complexity to build up. And then all of a sudden, boom, not in zero time, but in a very quick time, whatever it is, reaches a level of order, tends to stay there. A lovely example is the great red spot in Jupiter, which is like an anticyclone in Jupiter's weather. It was there when 300 and whatever it was years ago, when Galileo first turned his telescope on it. It's still there. It was probably there several hundred million years ago as well. Once these phenomena, because it's highly ordered, appear spontaneously, if the conditions remain suitable, they'll go on for a long time. They're highly stable. So we have complexity generating self-organization. And provided the conditions stay the same, stay suitable, it will be self-sustaining, far from, at a given distance from thermal equilibrium. So this would apply to the red spot on Jupiter. Boil a pan of water. Better do it golden syrup, because water is transparent, you can't see. Golden syrup. Boil it up. Initially it's all chaotic. Then all of a sudden, by magic, the convection currents organize themselves into beautiful, a dozen or so, perfectly hexagonal cross-sections. And if you keep the gas on and it doesn't all evaporate away, those hexagons will stay there permanently. Golden syrup will self-organize spontaneously given the right conditions. The red spot on Jupiter, they've got the Azores Hive sitting out in the North Atlantic, which more or less controls our weather. Or the Azores. Sometimes it moves up a bit and we get a good weather, sometimes it goes down and we get bad weather. But it's been there for hundreds and I dare say millions of years. But what happens with these things is that conditions get to a right point and then boom. And then it gets to what it is and it stays there, the red spot, the Azores Hive. A boiling pan of water is forever a boiling pan of water. But carbon chemistry does the same thing on the early Earth. The reason why carbon is most likely to produce things like us is because it is by far the most versatile of the elements in being able to combine with other elements. We're looking for complexity here, and it's obvious that the most complex structures are likely to emerge based on the most versatile of the elements. If on some other planet or universe somewhere there was some other element which was more versatile, twice as versatile as carbon, you'd be pretty sure that their life there would be based on that thing. So okay, the early Earth, the carbon just sits there and it's getting more and more complex. And obviously there are reactions taking place. Because what's happening is that the elements are coming together and of course falling apart because they haven't achieved sufficient complexity yet for this self-organizing. But then, boom, along comes self-organizing. But they don't leap instantly up to what we are and stay there forever. What happens there is instead of that line, you get something notionally like that. In other words, carbon chemistry produces the world is so versatile. It is able to respond to environmental changes, and besides which, when you get the stage of replication, which obviously would be an emergent property, replication is less than perfect. So what you tend to get with carbon, instead of a straight line here, you get increasing complexity. And the more complex it gets, the more stable it is. Until now, on Earth, for practical purposes, unless we are the Earth was zapped by the sun, by the expanding sun. It's hard to think of anything that could extinguish the whole of Earth, the whole of life, and every nook and cranny on Earth. It might kill all human beings or whatever, but in the deep sea, on these smoking holes at the bottom of the sea, other things would survive. So that's what I'm talking about here. And basically, we have to try to understand that we have complexity. Stability arising from self-organization and self-sustaining. That's all we've been trying to go into there, but that's the concept that I'm trying to get over. That's what life is. That's what the organic process is. It's carbon chemistry with all the things that are inherent in complexity. And everything, all the way up there, I said we went from single cell to multi-cell. That was an emergence multicellularity is an emergent product. But before that, right back at the beginning, the original molecules were bare, open to the atmosphere, so they were obviously vulnerable to, you know, changes in pH or something like that. One of the earliest things that evolved was, of course, a membrane to surround and protect. That is an emergent process. All the way up there, there are new emergent processes, because complexity is getting bigger, and that complexity itself, when allied to, you know, mutations due to cosmic rays or whatever, plus changes in the environment, gives rise, as we know, to the mechanism we know as natural selection. And so you have a benign circle started. And up here, where we are, somewhere up here, we are, in every sense of the word, the total of our emergent properties. And by that I mean everything, not only including genetic, physical, but our culture, our language, our consciousness. These are all the emergent products of this basic process. There was no stage in the process, I'll read this because it's very important that we get it right, no stage in the process sufficiently qualitatively different from those that immediately preceded it to justify calling the later one alive and the earlier ones not alive. That is, the attribution of life to a particular stage, for example the emergence of DNA, is arbitrary and justified, not at all. There was no one moment, no one development, natural, non-natural, or supernatural, that justified calling a particular organism the first human. If we had specimens of all our direct ancestors over the last 9 million years or so in front of us now, we would be hard-pushed to say exactly which was the first to be human, in the same way as we couldn't say which of our distant molecular ancestors was the first to be alive. It's a continuum. Being human is a physically emergent state, a natural result of the workings of the laws of physics, and it confers no privileged status. Yes, you and I are still fundamentally chemical processes. This is not to say nothing but chemical processes. I'm not reducing all that we are to chemical processes. Organisms, especially those further along the phylogenetic scale, have other real properties like sentience, consciousness, and self-consciousness. But apart from irrational belief, we have no cause to think these properties are other than physically determined, emergent as products of increasing complexity.
Sorry, is that apart from irrational belief?
Yes. This bit's in the handout, by the way. For our present purposes in relation to morality, the most important conclusion to be drawn here is that one of the main, and perhaps the main, characteristic of the organic process as a whole is its ability to sustain itself in the face of changing environments. Mechanisms have evolved to help with this, such as replication and natural selection, and these are all means to one thing, the continuing of the process. It's stable, self-sustaining, it simply continues, all other things be equal. No asteroids, etc., etc. This is the particular significance of stable and self-sustaining in the definition. Rather poetically, it's usually expressed as each organism having the will to live, what Schopenhauer regarded as the ordinary drive of life, the ongoing thrust, force. Remember I had force on the board? Thrust of being alive, or if you like, simply the will to survive, to keep going, at one with the forces that drive everything else in the universe. And those forces are what we call the laws of nature, the laws of physics, if you like. In particular, expressed through the almost incredible resistance to entropy highly complex structures have. It's very difficult to drive one of these things back down to there. You try and stop the red spot on Jupiter. My goodness, you need a lot of energy there. You need millions of black monoliths bombarded onto Jupiter to do that, I would have thought. Why does this drive to continue matter for morality? Because every organism and every cell in that organism has it and is a manifestation of it. Because it is the motive force underlying every act every bit of behavior of every organism all the time. Sometimes, of course, notably in humans, the behavioral connection can appear very indirect and obscure, especially when it's overlaid by our complex culture, or by pathology, we get ill, or by error, we make mistakes. But the organic imperative is still there, albeit well below the threshold of awareness. We're not aware of this, it's all unconscious, intuitive. At least until now we haven't been aware of it. The evolution of every species and the birth of every individual in those species are thus no more than particular manifestations of the laws of physics expressing themselves through the highly stable complexity that is the organic process. I'm saying no more than here, deliberately, and meaning it literally. All organisms have emergent properties, and humans seem to have more than their fair share, such as self-consciousness and language, but I would argue that every one of these properties was blindly selected to produce the same equally blind effect, to increase the probability that the larger process would continue. This seems almost teleological, but it's not. There is no ultimate telos out there pulling us towards it. There is only proximate push from within. Carbon chemistry contains its own driving force, if you like. Chemistry is basically electromagnetism. I'll come back to that later on. For morality, then, there is, as for every other bit of organic behavior, there is only one aim, one answer to what is it for, what is the good of it, and that is to increase the probability that the organic process will continue. How long the process continues remains to be seen. It was there long before humans evolved, and it will probably be there long after they've gone. Species and individuals do not matter in this context. They come and go, each successful in its time, as a temporary vehicle for the process. Mere continuing is therefore ultimately all there is. Let's call it C, the continuing. Continuance, if you like. And the drive, going back to the first one, what keeps us going is that. I'll call it ROC. For lack of a more imaginative phrase. That's what morality is about. Its evidence for ROC is a potentially fruitful theory of morality, but it appears able to subsume all other moral theories into itself. For example, it's entirely utilitarian and consequential. A thing is good, for example, only in as much as it is of instrumental utility towards C. It puts happiness into perspective as a means, a meter reading, an indicator of probable contribution towards C, rather than an end in itself. Good doesn't mean happiness. Happiness is a meter reading, how well you're doing in the business of living. It confirms the importance of a good will. Indeed, it says that will, arrow C, the will to live, is arrow C, is built into us. Though it confirms Kant's categorical imperative about seeking universalizable maxims for behavior, these things have to be universal, obviously, universalizable. While unlike Kant, providing at least a criterion, he didn't provide any criterion for his categorical imperative. We've got ROC as the criterion for testing our evidence, for testing our maxims. It appears to reject his treat people as ends, not means. Instrumentality means that every organism, as included, are means, not ends. People cannot help being mean towards seed. It is the essence of their organic nature. So what Kant is really saying is treat people as if they were ends, i.e. subscribe to this morally useful myth, since it will tend to maximize social utility, the fact that we are social being part of our biology and another of our evolved emergent strategies towards seed. For the heart of morality, the meaning of good, and derivatively bad, right, wrong, just, etc. What we're all doing when we use such language is intuiting a putative meaning for good. Good is the most fundamental of our concepts and deeply intuitive in all of us. When we call something good, what we're really saying is that it makes, or is likely to make, or is probability, a contribution to seed. That is, good is always instrumental, and a thing is good only in as much as it is instrumental towards seed, towards increasing the probability that the organic process will continue. Good things happen before humans appeared, i.e. our organic predecessors managed to keep the process going, though there were no minds around sufficient to register the fact. It's essential to this argument to understand that good is entirely internal to the organic process. Things are good only in as much as they contribute to seed. One thing is better or worse, more right or wrong than another, only in as much as it makes a greater or smaller contribution to or against seed. The organic process itself is neither good nor bad. Its existence is just a brute, contingent fact to which the universe appears to be indifferent. The fact that the organic process started and it is still going on Earth is just a brute fact about the universe. It contains nothing that we could call value, worth. We have no evidence that this earthly process plays a part in any larger scheme of things. In other words, the existence of life on Earth matters not one iota, except to those things that are part of it. Good and bad have no meaning when applied to the process itself, to see itself, the whole process, or to anything outside it, the rest of the universe. Whether or not the process succeeds in continuing does not matter at all. It has no value. You may not like this, but it follows inexorably from the premises of the theory. See, and therefore whatever contributes to see, have no value. I prefer to say intrinsic or even objective value, I think is even better. I'll hesitate for a moment. By the way, as it says, note this applies also to the use of good in relation to inanimate objects. A good hammer is one that does its job efficiently, which is to act as a tool, and tools are used for biological purposes, for example, to earn a living. A good hammer is thus also ROC, though indirectly, through use by a human being. Whether or not we exclude this use of good from what we call morality, limiting moral to only part of the behavior of our own species, matters little. The instrumental goodness of the hammer and of our moral acts amount to the same thing in the end, arrow seed. Good has one meaning, and only one. Test it yourself. Try a couple of thought experiments. Imagine being able to scan the surface of a planet that has no life on it. Careful not to introduce your own values, for example, those of a mineral prospector. About what could you possibly judge? That's good. I suggest about absolutely nothing. Why? Because there is nothing indigenous to the planet for the concept of good to get a grip on. You might momentarily think good if you spot traces of water or even of complex carbon-based molecules, common residue of meteorites at thermal equilibrium, but that thought would be no more than a projection of your own organic needs or a hope that an Earth-type organic process might someday evolve here also. These traces are potentially good, but they cannot become good in the absence of the right conditions for the spontaneous start of a relevant process. Next. Imagine you have to decide between alternative futures for the Earth. There are only two, and you must decide. No dodging. Also, you can't play for time hoping that something will turn up, nor can you invent new facts. First, 1,000 years from now, all human life will cease, but the remainder of the life process will continue into the indefinite future. Second, life on Earth, including human life, in other words, all life on Earth, will continue in all its varieties for 10,000 years, then all of it will cease forever. Which would you choose and why? You have to choose. If the theory of C is true, surely the first, since it maximizes the potential for good, which is arrow C. You would choose the second only if you judged that somehow human life is more good than any other. Because remember, it all disappears at the end of 10,000 years. How would you justify that somehow? This is in your pack. Good thing to take home and try to write down answers. Try to justify it. One frequent objection to any naturalistic theory of morality concerns instrumental versus intrinsic values. If natural morality is a matter of some X factor, for example, arrow C, and if this X is instrumental towards something like biological utility, where does that instrumentality cease? What is the ultimate source of these values? The general opinion of logicians, among others, seems to be that instrumentality has to end somewhere. Something ultimately has to have intrinsic value, i.e. be valuable in itself, not in relation to some other thing. Instrumentality, allegedly, cannot go on forever all the way down. But in C theory, though things are good only in as much as they are instrumental towards C, C itself, whether or not the organic process does continue, is value neutral. It's not of value and it's not of disvalue, it's simply a brute fact. Value neutral. It has no value, intrinsic or otherwise. It is just a brute fact about the universe. Instrumentality, therefore, under this theory, does not have to end up or point to intrinsic value. It can end up at value neutrality, and logically that is sufficient. Ultimately, there is no objective value in morality or in anything else. There is no telos, no ultimate proof from without. There is only proximate proof from within. There is only subjective value. We value arrow C. It would be difficult for us intuitively not to value it, wouldn't it? We value arrow C, but only subjectively. It has no objective worth. Good is only what we call arrow C. Value is something we impute to arrow C, imputare, to think in. We think it in, out of our minds. That's where it gets its value. We think it in. It isn't there prior to our thinking. See, arrow C in itself is not good. It is not of value in the sense of good being an objective predicate. Arrow C is what we call good. Arrow C itself is not objectively good, with good as in the sense of a predicate. Thus, that for something to be good is for it somehow to have something called value is a subjective illusion. Note, however, that to say that something is an illusion is not to say that it doesn't exist, but rather that it is not what it seems. What it seems to us for something to be good is that it is somehow of value. What it really is for something to be good is for it to be arrow C. We unknowingly impute value to arrow C. It's all done unconsciously, built into our, it's probably genetic. We unknowingly impute value to arrow C. We value arrow C subjectively, but nothing, not even C itself, has objective real value. What exists is arrow C, not value. Back to G.E. Moore. Is there no single word tautology for good? Surely there is, at least in C theory. Under C theory, good as arrow C is a scientific tautology. ROC can replace good in any proposition without loss or change of meaning. Okay, it's a single symbol tautology, but words are symbols anyway, so I think it qualifies in that sense. What about Moore's good is non-natural? There seem to be two possibilities here. That good is A, that good is outside the laws of nature, which is presumed to be non-natural. If so, good is non-causal. And so moral reasons are not causes. But surely the concept good does in fact, does as a matter of fact, motivate much of our behaviour. Especially the bit we call morality. So it must be causal. It seems that way. And surely reasons are what we take to be the causes of our beliefs. I do a moral thing for a reason, what I call a reason. Or secondly, good is, alternatively, good is non-natural because it is not real. For example, because it is its supposed value is illusory. But under C theory, though the concept of good being of value is illusory, the concept of good itself is not illusory. Good as ROC. ROC is a real physical drive underlying morality, underlying the carbon process. No, it is our concept of value that is an illusion. It is something we have invented that has evolved as part of our culture for our own subjective purposes, perhaps not to face the truth. Mrs. Darwin hated this bit of so-called truth. As we've seen, ROC, and therefore good, has no intrinsic value. We impute value to it. We invent its value. So in that sense, good is non-natural. So Moore was right in that sense, but only with the help of C theory. Now back to the naturalistic fallacy. In biologizing morality, are we still making a logically invalid leap from scientific facts to moral values? Does good means ROC seem, as Moore thought it must, somehow significant? That is it still somehow synthetic? Is it an open question? Can we still ask meaningfully, yes, but is ROC good? We can certainly ask that question. But the mere fact that we can ask it, and that it sounds as if it makes sense, doesn't mean that the naturalistic fallacy automatically bites. Contrary to what Hare, in my opinion, said, if good means ROC is, under C theory, a scientific tautology, then presumably ROC means good. But then, does ROC means good have the same meaning as ROC is good? Surely not. The sense in which we are asking, yes, but is ROC good, is not whether ROC and good refer to the same thing, whether they do or not, is a matter of theory, but rather that of good being a predicate, that is, the is indicates predication, not identity. In that, the open question, but is X good? The good there is a predicate, objective fact. It helps to remind ourselves that we equate being good with being of value, of worth. The alleged open question is then, okay, yes, but is ROC of value? As we've seen, value applies only within C, and then only instrumentally and subjectively. The question, yes, but is ROC of value, can therefore apply only within C. That is why questions like, but is happiness good, and is the survival of the human species good, because these have been put forward as the meaning of good many times, that's why they seem somehow significant, somehow meaningful, somehow open questions. It's hardly surprising that we consider them significant, because we are the organic process. Happiness, yes, obviously good, but it's not the definition of good. Why? Because inside C, they can be answered by a yes or by a don't know. Is the survival of the species good? Yes. Somebody might say, I don't know. But the fact that you can answer these, they make sense inside the organic process because you can actually give them answers. It would be surprising if we didn't intuit such questions as meaningful and were not inclined to answer yes. However, outside C, there is no value, and so the answer to yes, but is arrow C good, is a clear and emphatic no. And that closes the question. The naturalistic fallacy does not bite C theory. It bites only concepts that lie within the organic process. That's why I prefer to speak of natural morality. I've deliberately avoided evolutionary morality, because life proper is often, in evolutionary studies, taken to have begun only with the emergence of DNA, or perhaps of replication. And so the significance of C, of looking at the whole of the organic process, remains hidden. Good as arrow C avoids this mistake, and so can answer a firm no to Moore's and Hare's open question. Back to the is-ought gap.
On to the next point about this. By the way, I'm running behind time, so I'm going to make an unilateral decision to eat into question time, so there's more this afternoon. I'm hoping that's more to do. Because I think it's important to get to the end of this. You've got this. The wording on mine is slightly better. And a couple of days back is yours. I'm hoping with a combination of that and what you've got in front of you, you can get by without being confident. Is that okay? Now, what I'm going to do first of all is to cover up to there. We're back here, what I call conventional morality. Faced with this problem, you've all to do that. That X is what's been called the prescriptive X. It's not quite an inheritance. It's not as strong as it says, but it's prescribing what someone's doing. We've seen that again in the basic form. Now, in various scientific approaches to morality that I've read over the years, a common analogy they use is thunder and lightning. Having just seen a flash of lightning, in other words, what is the case? If you're relevant, i.e. hearing facilities, etc., are fully developed and intact, Cateri's paribus, for example, move back in. By the way, Cateri's paribus has to be invented pretend to be scientific, he didn't say all the matter for probably. Newton's laws were only Cateri's paribus because of Einstein's you ought to, i.e. you will, hear thunder. And this ought to is descriptive. You will hear thunder. You can't tell by you thunder. And it's predictive. It is not prescriptive. Most of the sort of theory of naturalistic theory and philosophy end there because they see that ought and that ought, and they see them different. This is clearly a predictive, you will. This one seems to have some other element. It seems to have a special moral quality of itself. Under C theory. Under C theory, we're repeating this. Faced with this moral problem, what is the case? If you're relevant, i.e. ROC faculties are fully developed and intact, put on to the scientific bit now, Cateri's paribus, nothing's preventing you, nobody's twisting your arm or whatever, you ought to, you will do X. And under ROC, that is descriptive, predictive. You will do it. It is in your nature to do it. But you do not. All other things you need. Provided, for example, you're not a member of the audience, you're just trying to get into it.
Now it's important to look here. These notes are important. Note one there, you ought to do X. That X in that case would be the right thing, this conventional variety for our case. That's the right thing to do under your society's moral code, for example, people thought. Note two, which is here and here, in this bit of the two scientific ones. However, note that this predictive will indicates probability. All these probabilities. So it's common. Number three. Where's number three? There you are. If your faculties are relevant, moral faculties are fully developed and intact, in practice this will depend on your society's culture. To what extent that culture's moral code, which is yours, is piracy will be an empirical matter. There are so many different cultures of the world and all different moral codes. They can't all be equally valid. Some must be more than others. I think that's quite interesting. When I set out to write it down, I found the more I wrote it down, the more interesting it became. I'll leave it up for a moment. The attempts at naturalistic ethics I've seen get no further than the second one, because they don't present their theories as fully and unequivocally scientific. Their proponents think that the moral ought, though analogous to the scientific ought, is still somehow different, and that somehow arises from their assumption that moral behaviour is something special, that it exists in some other realm, totally separate from the other, quote, merely biological behaviour of humans and other organisms, for example, feeding, procreating, using tools. Under good as arrows see, the moral law is fully and directly scientific, in that all organic behaviour, including the bits we call moral, is hypothesized as an integral part of nature. That is, there is no other realm. In conventional morality, the middle premise, notice the top, forget the Kepri's parables, if your relevant faculties are intact, developed and intact. In conventional morality, that bit's omitted. And you go from what is the case to what you ought to do. That is what confused Hume when he saw the apparently unjustified leap from is to ought. His alleged fact value gap does have a logically valid bridge, albeit an unstated intuitive one. Okay, if good means arrow C, it must appear somehow in contemporary morality. How does it get into it in practice? Well, I'm going to condense hugely here because I haven't time to go through. What I'm basically saying here is, I'll read a little bit of it. When I see my baby developing, a newborn baby, I understand how he may be going to achieve this miracle of unification. Initially, he starts out with all his limbs, all the things you can see, eyes, limbs, you know, hands, legs, all flashing around. But gradually and fairly quickly, each system, limbs and eyes and voice, gradually becomes unified in itself. And also they all gradually become unified. And this is a miracle. Any of us who've been parents. When I see my baby developing, I begin to understand how in fact he may be going to achieve this miracle of unification. It will not be, as I might have thought, through the power of a somehow separate supervisory self, which emerges from nowhere, but through the power inherent in all his subcells, i.e. his various body and brain systems, for literally their own self-organization. Where does self-organization come from? Complexity. What's the most complex thing in the universe? The human brain. That's where the unity of the babies. And this is what the cell thinks. The self is a virtual system. It's all these inputs unified into the brain, and the brain constructs a self, a model. I'm sorry we haven't time here because it needs a lot deeper. We might find a little bit of time later on. A couple of quotations which I'll have to miss out, unfortunately. They talk about mind. I don't like it, the use of mind here. It's too vague a concept. It's too often taken to refer to another separate entity, like the supervisory self. Philosophers are perhaps to blame because they often use mind to refer only to consciousness. I prefer conscious and unconscious brain process, not mind or mental. I hope you won't catch me out very often using the word mind or mental. In an adult, we have a more or less fully developed self system, this virtual model coded into the brain in terms of neural connections. Not coded in ones and zeros as it is on your PC, but nevertheless coded as a virtual system. In an adult, we have a more or less fully developed self-system to help the brain to mediate all our behavior. Morality is only a part. Metaphorically, each of us has a morality room in his head, around the walls of which are hundreds of pegs, each with a moral rule, maxim, or bit of learnt behavior, prototype behavior, hanging on it. When a moral problem arrives, the brain unconsciously scans around the pegs, selects the maxim that seems the most relevant, and then acts on it. Sometimes the action will be accompanied by consciousness, for example, when there are competing maxims, i.e. conflictions. These conscious adjuncts are what we call a reason for acting. Intuitively, we think they are all that's going on, because one of these maxims just pops into our head. We think they are all that's going on, and that they have been generated by the separate supervisory self, not virtual self, the separate supervisory self, via free will. I go on to say that there is no such thing as free will. The brain, using this self model system, can generate acts only that are within the capacities of the information it contains. And as an information processing device, and assuming a fairly high degree of efficiency, it will generate. What happens is that there are all sorts of competing things come up in the brain, you know, from the old self, emotion, the reptilian brain, and all sorts of things come up, selfish, social, and so on. The brain has to pick out among them, which is it going to pick out? The one that seems to be most ROC. And that's the one that it does, acts on, or brings into consciousness. And it can do no other. It can do no other than process the information it actually has coded into itself. There is no free will. Subjectively, however, we think otherwise. We think we have acted entirely consciously, deliberately, from the reasons we have in mind. Hume was aware of this when he said, reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, though unfortunately he didn't justify the ought. Only recently have we begun to understand just what a large part the emotions play in all of this. Indeed, they are dominant. I'm picking quickly now. ROC is the fundamental drive behind all of our behavior, including the moral, and behind all of our emergent properties. We are the sum of our emergent properties, which include the self system, consciousness, language, morality, and all that goes to make up our culture. I'll go to the last page now. This is as far as we've got time to go into. I've missed some important stuff, but I think you've got the drift, I trust. As I said at the beginning, all I'm trying to cover is the gist of what I think a theory of natural morality should look like. I'm not saying this is the finished product. In this afternoon's short session, I'll go a little bit further with some implications. The main points to note: C theory corresponds with the facts of the world, at least as I see them. It is coherent and it is plausible to intuition. It is testable and falsifiable. Pick something you consider to be truly good, analyze it, and try to prevent it from leading you to arrow C. Pick something that clearly contributes to arrow C, apple pie, good things, digestion and so on, and try to conclude logically that it's bad. You'll fail. If you find one, let me know pronto. The only one I could think of in terms of good was goodbye. Of course that isn't, because that's God be with you, isn't it? C theory can synthesize and reconcile other competing theories, for example virtue theory, deontology and utilitarianism, showing how each contains part of the truth. Also, it appears to transcend them. It does not commit the naturalistic fallacy. It shows, it gets us logically from is to ought. It shows that morality has a kind of telos, proximate, not ultimate. What other moral theory comes anywhere near doing all of this? What C theory does not do is give meaning to each life other than as a temporary manifestation of and vehicle for the organic process. But why not rejoice in that? You'll have made your contribution, you'll have done your bit. C theory contains no otherworldly dimension. It accounts for our moral psychological states as responses to states of affairs in the world, as emergent products of a physical process, but not as indications of or channels to any supernatural dimension. C theory is natural through and through. It shows good to be not only the primary human concept, but also the clue to understanding the basic nature of ourselves and of every other organism. Also, and possibly most importantly at this time, it puts into perspective, I think, I hope, the ecological movement and our growing realization that we need to begin to look after all of the biosphere. We are an integral part of that whole process, but we have no relevantly special place in it. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I found that really exciting. I've scribbled here, I thought it beautifully clear, I thought it wonderfully consistent. I don't think I've ever heard such a clear and consistent statement in naturalistic ethics. One doesn't have to, of course, agree that it's true. and I actually disagree quite profoundly with Tom, but that doesn't matter, because I think actually for somebody who disagrees so profoundly, it's actually really exciting to hear such a crisp and clear statement of the opposing theory. So let's give him another clap.